MGM studio chief Louis B. Mayer called it the most important story he would ever film. The Beginning or the End was a big-budget dramatization of the Manhattan Project and the invention and use of the revolutionary new weapon. Now published as The World Marks the 75th Anniversary of the Bombings, The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, is a book from award-winning author Greg Mitchell, which chronicles the never-before-told story behind Hollywood's historic flop and the secret campaign to silence the scientists who tried to warn the world about a nuclear arms race. Again, the name of the book is The Beginning or the End, and we welcome Greg Mitchell to the roundtable this morning. Greg, thank you very much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
So what brought you to this particular subject?
Well, I've been writing about the atomic bomb and the atomic bombing since the 1980s. I was became editor of a magazine called Nuclear Times then, and it kind of led me, although I've written a dozen books, I've now written three on this overall subject. So I first heard about this MGM movie, maybe 30 years ago, and I was at the Truman Library, and came across a big file there of correspondence between the White House and MGM demanding changes in the script and a retake of the key scene in the movie coming directly from Truman and the White House, which was quite shocking to me, unprecedented. And so it kind of made me look at the entire production of this 1947 movie and how it had started out as a warning from the scientists about the future of developing nuclear weapons, nuclear arms race, bigger and worse weapons, a hydrogen bomb, and so forth. And it was transformed over the course of a year, thanks to pressure from the White House and the military, into a movie that eventually became very pro-bomb and very endorsing the attacks on Japan and so forth. So it was interesting subject, sort of untold story, and I then kept researching it, and over the years, and finally got a chance to do a full book about it.
This is something that they wanted to be a big budget movie, taking a look at the Manhattan Project and dramatizing what happened. So 75 years later, we look at this film, and by all accounts, it turned out to be a flop, right? I mean, it was bad.
Yeah. Well, it got mixed reviews, actually. I think it's a little too easy to say it was a complete bomb, so to speak. But it got mixed reviews and, a modest box office.
So I'm interested in what the mindset was of wanting to do a film really so close to when the event occurred.
Well, people who maybe younger people or people don't know the era that well, this was seen, I think, rightly at the time, the invention of the atomic bomb and then using it in the war as the most important event of the entire century. And people were happy that the war ended for whatever reason, but terrified of the future under nuclear umbrella, and certainly fears about now what the U.S. could eventually be attacked, could be the end of the world, and so on and so forth. So you can't underestimate the importance of that story. And in fact, MGM wanted to bring the movie out quicker, which would have helped at the box office. But because of these countless revisions that were ordered by the Pentagon and the White House, the movie was delayed, and it was delayed. It didn't come out until more than a year and a half after the atomic bombing. So by then, people were trying to turn the page more.
Let's talk a little bit about, as you do in the book, about the creative team behind the movie. This is quite a gallery of people, isn't it?
Well, it was ordered by Louis B. Mayer, the famed studio chief at MGM. He called it would be the most important movie he ever made. It was one of the original docudramas, which is now a longtime genre where it would have some elements of nonfiction, but also fiction. So they set out to make this movie, and they hired screenwriter Frank Weed, who was a well-known screenwriter, and Bob Considine, who was a well-known Hearst columnist, came up with the real story. Interestingly, which is kind of amazing for most people to hear this, but Paramount developed a competing film. In fact, the New York Times and others loved to chronicle what they called this race, first race for the atomic bomb movie. And Paramount hired Ayn Rand to write their screenplay. And most people are surprised to even know she did such things, but she had written a couple previous screenplays, and so she was hired to write the screenplay. So in my research, I trace for the first time all of her outlines and her correspondence and her early scripts and so forth. And so that was a competing project. And then ultimately, because her script was kind of so wacky, Paramount gave up and sold out to MGM. So there was just the one movie that was developed. But it was quite a saga and covered very closely in the press.
One of the things that is also fascinating here is, well, you start off really with this. Talk about Donna Reed's involvement.
Yes. Again, I don't know how many people today remember Donna Reed, but she, of course, had the famous TV show in the 60s. But before that, she won an Oscar for From Here to Eternity. And before that, she was Jimmy Stewart's wife and in the most famous Christmas movie these days. She was, a young actress then, and her high school chemistry teacher happened to send her a letter revealing that he had disappeared because he had, was working in the top secret Manhattan Project in Tennessee, and he wrote a letter to her saying the atomic scientists were just scared, terrified about the future development of more and bigger bombs and warning of the nuclear arms race. And he begged her to get a big budget Hollywood movie made that would warn the world about the dangers of going down this path. Her husband was a Hollywood agent. He was able to sit down with MGM, and that's how the whole ball got rolling. But it came about because of Donna Reed's former chemistry teacher from high school.
The Beginning or the End starred Brian Dunleavy, Robert Walker, Tom Drake, Beverly Tyler, Audrey Totter, and Hume Cronin. So the cast came in at what point? Was it quickly cast?
No, it's not 100% sure what happened, because originally they were suggesting in the press they might get Spencer Tracy or Clark Gable. And it became lesser known actors. Now, it's possible that their claim was that they didn't want to capsize the sort of documentary aspect by having these matinee idol stars. It's also possible they spent so much on special effects that they didn't have much of a budget left. So it's a little unclear. Hume Cronin played Oppenheimer. And there's funny episodes in the book. Oppenheimer, of course, is known as the father of the atomic bomb, and famous for being conflicted about helping to make the bomb and so forth. And he was very conflicted about this movie. And one of the main subplots of the book really is this desperate attempt by MGM to get the famous people they wanted to be portrayed to sign releases. To allow that. And so some people went along easily, but especially the scientists didn't really want to do it. They didn't want to be portrayed on the screen. And then when they started to see the script, they had problems with it. They could see what direction it was going. And, Oppenheimer is one of the main characters in the book, as they keep trying to get him to sign, and they meet with him, and he's mocking the movie. But at the same time, because he's Oppenheimer, he likes the attention. He likes the feeding the ego. So ultimately, he agrees to be portrayed while continuing to mock the movie. Hume Cronin, who played him, wrote a letter to him. Hume Cronin himself was mocking the script. So it was pretty bad. And the other thing that was going on, again, a subplot, I guess you'd say, was that at the same time all this was going on with the movie, the FBI was surveilling Albert Einstein, Leo Szilard, and Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer, they even tapped his phone, and I have some excerpts from transcripts, FBI transcripts, where Oppenheimer is mocking the movie in these FBI phone taps. So that's all going on at the same time. These scientists were suspected of being, you know, pro-communist or at least too far left-wing anyway. And so J. Edgar Hoover was, was trying to get the goods on them. So there's a lot going on. I mean, the book is partly about the making of this movie and all this, the changes. It's also partly about the time and things like, coming of the Cold War. And then, of course, the decision to drop the bomb, the movie, all the revisions are in the direction of endorsing Truman's decision. And so in the course of the book, we get the reasoning for his decision and why it was controversial or why they felt they needed to, revise or put the narrative out there. And so in the course of the book, you do get the heated debate, I guess you'd say, over the actual use of the bomb and the aftermath and so forth. So it's pretty well rounded, I think.
The president, Harry Truman, played a large role in this. He was, you talk about, I can think of no better word, I guess, than interference, but he really got involved. He wanted there to be revisions. He wanted there to be retakes. He even wanted a say on who played him.
Yes, they managed to get the actor fired who played him. Basically what happened was after all these revisions, they had the first screening of the movie in Washington. And Truman's press secretary attended and was just outraged by the key scene in the movie, which leads up to Truman making his decision to use the bomb. And so the White House ordered a retake, which was very costly and very late. And they were the script was written, and the White House went over the script, edited the script, and it was filmed by MGM word for word. So it's sort of an unprecedented, I don't know what you call it, suppression or censorship or whatever, but so that was carried out. And basically, again, the point of it all was to show Truman making the decision in a very, calm, protracted, way and explaining all the things that we now see in the what we call the Hiroshima narrative, which is it was the only thing that could be done to end the war. It was, and in fact, it ended the war. It saved a million American lives. The Japanese were, there's no mention of, Russia entering the war at the same time. There's no mention of Japan attempts to surrender, feelers that were sent out and so forth. So it boils it down to what is still the Hiroshima narrative today. And it was important, at least it was seen by the White House as important to get that down, get that out to this movie audience, and not allow any kind of doubts to seep in with any other evidence or facts or questions that were raised.
One of the final chapter of the book is called Aftermath, 1947 to 2020. So what do you believe happened as a result of this film, and as the subtitle would suggest, that how Hollywood and America learned to stop worrying and love the bomb?
Well, I think it's revealing that in 75 years now, there's only been 3 Hollywood movies on the subject. Now, yes, there's been plenty of what you might call nuclear movies, from Dr. Strangelove and Failsafe and On the Beach and on. But actually taking up the making and the use of the bomb, there's only been 3 in 75 years, and only 1 in the last, 70 years, really. There's got to be a reason for that. And, the book argues that the reason is that the use of the bomb against Hiroshima, although it's still endorsed by majority or close to a majority of Americans, it does strike us that it's sort of a raw nerve, we call it. It's something about it bothers us, as rightly it should. We killed 200,000 people, 90% of them civilians. At the same time, with the media and officials continue to endorse that, and this is, I guess, what has driven my interest in this, over many decades now is that it's not over and done with. The U.S. today still has 5,000 nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert. We still have what's known as a first use policy, which means any president has the right to use nuclear weapons first in any conflict, even if a conventional attack or even the threat. And, and polls show that, again, close to a majority of Americans claim they would endorse a first strike on, let's say, Iran or Korea, killing, hundreds of thousands of people or millions even, if the U.S. feels threatened. Not that we've already been attacked. It's not retaliation. So now whatever you think of that policy, or whatever you even think of the use of the bomb against Japan, that is a dangerous situation. And now some people think President Trump is particularly dangerous. That could be true also. But any president has that right. And so the exceptions to the, we sort of have a saying, sort of, well, we must never use nuclear weapons, But yet, we did use them twice, and most in the media and a large number of the public are in the public continue to endorse that. And so we have this exception, we have this precedent, and any president could, cite that in the future that, look what happened. We had to drop the bomb in 1945 and it, ended the war, and, maybe we have to, we could use it again. So that's why it's a topical issue. It's not, here's an old movie, who cares? We dropped the bomb in 1945. What can we do about that now? And so forth. To me, it's an everyday, topical, relevant subject.
The name of the book is The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. The book is published by The New Press. Greg Mitchell, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. I'm very happy to do this.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, The Beginning or the End, published by The New Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.